VentureCast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What do you got?
We're allowed, this is in no particular order, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can go and you can alternate if you want.
All right, so this is going to be tough. Fans of the podcast will know this is not a good first pick, but You Can't Hurry Love the Supremes.
Nice. Right.
That to me, like, there are songs that I like better.
Yeah.
But that one to me is the Motown song sound. Like, I just freaking love that one.
Awesome.
I'm going to,
awesome.
Yeah, that's now, a great one.
Do you prefer the Supremes or the Phil Collins?
You're the best, Jimmy. This is a perfect follow-up
really
question.
Great gift on this Sunday, Jim. I love it.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Are you doing well, Jeff Simons?
Doing great. I've got my industrial strength coffee.
Yeah.
And
you're on the
rolling.
West Coast.
I'm doing the Ben Barton no shower weekend, which is making me very happy and progressively making my family sad. But I'm going to commit to it for the rest of the day.
Have you trademarked that?
So I would love to claim that that's defamatory, but it's totally accurate. And it'll stretch longer than a weekend. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. And Ben, you're not in your office.
No, I decided to do it at home today.
All right. Let's go. This is 50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys on the Electricast podcast network. Hoping to connect with you on Facebook or on Instagram or on Threads. Today, our musical road trip brings us to Detroit, Michigan. Raise your hand if you're excited.
Oh, I'm raising two hands.
Raise your hand if you've been to Detroit.
I've been to Detroit with a member of this podcast.
Oh, what you guys do in Detroit?
We went to a Tigers game at Old Tiger Stadium, and then Ben drove me around the Blight so I could really get a sense of just how burnt out Detroit was. That was in the early 90s.
Okay.
At a particular low point.
Yeah, right. Different place 30 years
Detroit
later.
Detroit lost another 400,000 people after that game.
That's just unbelievable. It's really, that's so shocking because it was empty when we went there. It was incredible.
Dude, that, every time. Yeah. And we'll talk about it, but it's in a rally right now. It's in a,
yeah.
It's moving into a better place. But no, I just couldn't believe that because I knew India worked in Detroit for a year and I got to know that town medium intimately. And I couldn't believe that more people left.
What year was that, before or after you went to the baseball game with Jeff, that India worked
Same,
there?
Basically, India worked there. I graduated law school in 96, and so she worked there in 95, 96.
Okay.
And she worked in a demography firm. So she worked at like a little census outpost in Detroit.
Wow.
With tumbleweeds going by,
as people are bleeding.
Oh, dude, it was
away.
Such a like. It was a really, really great job. So it's a husband and wife, old school Jewish couple from Detroit, and she was, and they were obsessed with Detroit and Detroit's population. So India got the full tour, like of everything.
That's cool.
Like this is where the synagogues were, this is where the people were, this is where the riots happened. Everything.
Well, I mean, as long as we're on the topic, Ben Barton. And you want to do a little Sunday morning flexing. City population of Detroit, according to the last census.
You're the best. I did not look this up, and I'm going to be awry. I'm going to be wrong.
Okay.
let's go with the city itself is 245,000 people.
639,000, right?
A lot more than I thought. That's great.
Giving me no chance. I love that on a day when we just lost Bob Barker, you did not give me a chance to go higher or lower.
I'm so sorry.
Come on now.
Would you have gone higher or lower?
I would have gone higher.
What was the population of St. Louis? St. Louis was tiny.
Tiny. Yeah. I think it was like 250, right?
Was what made me think that Detroit had to be in the similar spot. Because, I mean, St. Louis was the fourth biggest city in America in 1900. Detroit was the fifth biggest city in America in 1950, which is a little more recent.
Fourth biggest in 1920. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It went New York, Philly, Chicago, then Detroit in 1920. Jeff Simons
all through the 50s, right?
Yeah, and then it was a powerhouse through the 50s. Jeff Simons, I apologize as a way of apologizing. Metro area population of Detroit,
including suburbs, it's 600,000 in the city itself. I'm going to go with 1.7 million in the metro area.
So I shouldn't give Ben. You're going to what?
I'm going to go over.
It's 4.3 in the metro.
How is that possible?
By the way, we sucked today, Jeff. At least I knew it was more than that. Dude, the metro area is gargantuan. That's the irony of Detroit.
You don't have to tell me. I live in the Bay Area, but the sprawl population of the Bay Area is like three times the three cities. So that's why I was like 1.8. But that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
80% of the population is outside the city.
All right, we're flying in. We're landing. Wheels hit the tarmac. And Alice Cooper welcomes us to Detroit. Let's go. Jeff Simons, my whole life I've kind of conflated or confused or couldn't tell apart Ted Nugent from Alice Cooper.
It's because they both became angry conservative golfers in their old age. Yeah.
Real quick, what's the difference?
Big difference, actually. I got a big difference. Ted Nugent was always in the much more of a flashy guitar hero hard rock vein. Ted Nugent's like big calling card was the guitar solos, and Alice Cooper was more of a glam metal, like the show has like all these themes and nightmares and Halloweenish, like there were guillotines on stage and fake blood and Alice Cooper's a band, not just a guy.
Okay.
And Ted Nugent is very aggressively just a dude. So
okay.
But there's a real, like, if you're in 1975, the difference between Cat Scratch Fever and No More Mr. Nice Guy is probably pretty, pretty thin. Alice Cooper is the first music I bought with my own money. I bought a cassette single of No More Mr. Nice Guy in the mall in Los Angeles.
They made cassette singles?
4 years old.
Waste of plastic.
But it was like a new thing. It was like a cigarette machine filled with music. And I was 4 years old visiting my grandparents. And we're walking out of the mall and they were a nickel. So my grandfather was like, something. So I went chink and yanked. And so every time we went to the mall, I got one. So that summer I got Alice Cooper's No More Mr. Nice Guy, Seals and Crofts, Summer Breeze.
Let's go.
And Eddie Kendrick's Keep on Truckin'. Three like blue.
This explains a lot, Jeff.
I mean, so
those three really just formed your DNA.
Is it amazing?
At 4 years old, Jeff's like, yeah, No More Mr. Nice Guy. Let's go. Well, Alice Cooper's Detroit City as our arrival song was kind of a last.
You did that instead of Kiss's Detroit Rock City.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about
that,
but that's okay.
Your thinking process.
I hate Kiss, but they may make an appearance in a little bit.
Yeah, all right. So then, Jeff, you agree with me, right?
Which is what?
Detroit Rock City is the obvious. Like,
yes, and hating Kiss is what a waste of energy. Like, that's like hating like Enemans chocolate frosted donuts. Like, you can avoid them, but hating them.
That said, Kiss isn't from Detroit, right? They're from
From Long Island.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. So, I mean, that you can make that argument, Timmy.
Also, Enemans Pop'ems, like the little hole donuts.
Yeah, baby.
Those things. You go through a box of those, man. Just keep them out of your house. That's my big advice. You bring them into the house, it's over. No, I wanted a Motown song, and it made the most sense that I'm going to arrive in Motown. I'm going to play Motown. And I spent days torturing myself, unable to pick the right Motown song. So that's when I texted you guys. What did I ask you for? Top three Motown songs of all time?
Yeah, something like that.
Top five. I cannot
wait. What's great about that is I think I had hard opinions on whether it should be top three or top five, and then I totally forgot about the homework. So this is going to be great.
Oh, me too. I have no clue.
So not going to be hard, though.
So my very specific homework. I'll go first so you guys could think a little bit. And I felt I was going to get killed if this was my arrival song because the Isley Brothers were from Cincinnati.
Yes.
But they started their own label. I didn't know Jimi Hendrix was their guitarist for a little bit, which is fascinating. But when their own label goes under, they go to Detroit and they record for Motown and they record my favorite Isley Brothers song, This Old Heart of Mine.
It's a great one.
Originally written for the Supremes by Motown. I can't remember the name of Motown's like writing team that was just cranking
Holland Dozier Holland.
Holland Dozier Holland. So they write that for the Supremes. They end up giving it to the Isley Brothers, and the Isley Brothers crush it. But then they leave Motown right after that album. So it didn't seem fair to pick that as my song. All right, let's hear it.
What do you got? You want to go first, Ben?
Top five Motown songs all time in your list. What do you got?
Okay, we're allowed. This is in no particular order, right?
Yeah. You could go and you can alternate. If you want.
All right, so this is going to be tough. Fans of the podcast will know this is not a good first pick, but You Can't Hurry Love the Supremes.
Nice. Right.
That to me, like there's songs that I like better.
Yeah.
But that one to me is the Motown sound. Like I just freaking love that one.
Awesome.
That's now, a great one.
Do you prefer the Supremes or the Phil Collins?
You're the best, Jimmy. This is a perfect follow-up
really
question.
Great gift on this Sunday, Jim. I love it.
I'm going to go with Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell.
Oh, that's another great one. Oh. I strongly thought about that.
When he goes, woo, in the third verse.
Unbelievable.
It's the greatest.
All right.
Field delivered Stevie Wonder. And
awesome.
That is probably actually my favorite one.
I'll go with Money by Barrett Strong, which was the first really big Motown hit and just cracks me up. The best things in life are free, but you can leave them to the birds and bees. Just give me money. That's what I want.
That's a Detroit original right there.
Right?
That's fair enough. Fair enough. Let's get it on.
Woo!
Ooh, I love
Excellent.
That one.
All right. And my pick for the most Motown sounding Motown song, Tears of a Clown by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, with that doot 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 and the loudest tambourine ever recorded so that white people can clap along.
And Tracks of My Tears. Like, it wasn't until I started trying to figure out which song I was going to pick that I realized just how big Smokey Robinson was. Guy was huge for a 5-year period. Top of the world.
There's a great old clip. I can't remember what it's from. It's from some old rock and roll movie where this kid's listening to music in his room and the dad comes in. He's like, turn that garbage down. And the kid's like, but dad, it's Smokey.
All right. What else?
Stay on the board. My next pick is going to be completely off the ranch, but I'm going to go with, and you can take either ABC or I Want You Back, or I really consider them the same song. So I'm going to take both of them.
Okay. Yeah. Can I just agree?
Yes.
Okay. And then we got one more round. I'll go last on my all-time favorite Motown song, and it's past the prime moment, but his papa was Rolling Stone by the Temptations.
Yes, we've discussed this before. I'm going to go even further past. Did you know that Super Freak by Rick James is a Motown number?
That's great.
And you know I'm choosing that.
And that apologies to my dad for not choosing Bernadette. His
Bernadette was
favorite,
right there.
Well, honorable mention.
Left it on the board. Who else? Gladys Knight?
We're missing the most underrated band, in my opinion, is the Marvelettes. Like, I wish the Marvelettes were Diana Ross and the Supremes. Like, Please, Mr. Postman. And, like,
oh, that's a great
Heat Wave. Those songs are fantastic. I don't know why Martha Reeves didn't and the Vandellas didn't get bigger than Diana Ross as well. So,
yeah,
Ain't Too Proud to Beg, that's a great right? one. That kind of hurts us.
What's that?
We didn't get Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
Oh, I think it's impossible to do it right. I mean, there's 100 of them that could make the list. It's just incredible.
All right, we're moving on because despite the fact that I am currently on sabbatical. Whew,
how about that?
Have you guys, this whole sabbatical thing.
Careful.
Look into it.
Careful with the rubbing it in.
Looking into it.
And meanwhile, though, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you've been following your local high school volleyball. Even on sabbatical, the Asheville Blues are off to a wickedly strong start. So I'm sure we'll be hearing about that in future podcasts.
I will still be coaching. We've got one of the deepest teams I've ever had. Super excited. Especially after our 5-set barn burning victory, down 13-9 in the 5th set, and we came back and won. So I was super excited. But we've got film this afternoon. That film's not going to break down itself. So we are going to move on.
Ben, did you play high school sports? You did, right?
No, dude. I went to a gargantuan, massive urban high school where I tried out for the basketball team and they laughed me out of the gym.
I thought you played like,
there
you
were 1,500 kids in my freshman year class.
Right,
so
right,
I was
right.
Not okay. One of the five.
I assumed you played soccer, one of the ones that they needed kids for. But
nah.
I mean, I never looked at film. I don't think there's no way my high school, if the word film had been said in high school, we'd been like, oh, we're going to watch 16 Candles? Like, I just, crack me up, buddy.
I'm going to get them all in the room and show The Godfather. Let's get to the Detroit compilation. Let's hear what you guys. Oh, by the way, with the torture basement, some of these were so obvious, I cut it down to one word. So it's going to be super fast. You've got 15. You need to get 13 out of 15, even including those one word.
13 out of 15.
13 out of 15. Let's do it. I believe in you.
You're a monster.
By the way, I love that it only took 14 minutes for you to say we're going to cut this. So for those of you playing, we're going to cut this bingo. The answer was 14 minutes. when he will definitely not go back and cut that.
I will cut. Jeff Simons, you don't even listen to this podcast. You have no idea the magic I'm performing.
Do I even appear on this podcast? Or is this like you guys, just a big ruse? All right, here we go. Torturing from Detroit. By the way, friends, Timmy spiffed up the torture basement. He's got a Woodstock poster in the background this year. So looking very nice.
It's from my classroom. That
sabbatical.
With the sabbatical, I had to
had to bring the goodies home. I love it.
By the way, Ben Barton, writing a book is hard. I need help with Helen asked me that day, well, who's your audience? And I was like, me? And apparently I need to think that through. So we'll talk offline.
I have two very brief pieces of advice.
Oh, please.
Piece number one, have I previously described the word Sitzfleisch?
Yes.
This is the German word for ass sit, and that's the deal with the book. You just sit your ass in that chair, and that's how it gets written. If your ass is not sitting in the chair, it does not get written.
And sometimes what you get down on paper is going to be crap.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then my second piece of advice, and this your mileage will vary with this, is to actually have a word count in mind. Go Charles Dickens style. The word count for my books are all 75,000 words. And when I hit 75,000, a couple of them got to 80, but I mean, then I'm like, well, I'm done.
So a word count.
A word count. And then you can, literally when you get to 25,000, you're like, oh, I have a third of a rough draft. Like you can, it's like a little meter where you can see it filling up like the grain silo. And then at the end, you're at the top, and then you can go back and re-edit it.
And then when you go back and search for the word very and cut it out and you're down 4,000 words, you got to keep going.
Aren't you writing by chapter?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right.
And like, I actually have each chapter with a word count on that, a running word count by chapter.
Super.
And then you write a horrible first draft and you get all of those words down and then you go back and fix it and you're off to the races.
Sweet. Got it. This is the kind
of
thing
we do.
Can we
have a Timmy's book update regular feature this year as we move forward?
Oh my gosh.
It's going to be great.
Let's do it.
Because if you don't, I'm gonna write and read fake excerpts from your book. So that's my
that's a good threat. All right.
The Torture Basement, number your pages 1 through 15. We're getting 15. 13 of them. Let's go.
Here we go.
All right. We'll
There's no 15th.
It. What's that?
That was 14. Yeah, I don't know.
I missed Big Sean so much more. Darn it.
Yes, I did not hear that.
You did not hear Big Sean. It was good, too. All right. All right, hit me.
Okay, here we go. Second round. I think this is Patti Smith. 25 stories of Detroit.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, good. I wasn't sure if it was them or Queens of the Stone Age. Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Detroit.
Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry.
Big question mark.
Detroit.
Huey Lewis. White Stripes.
That's Nickelback.
It was Nickelback.
That's like, I have two guesses on that one. And obviously, our friends from Journey. Okay,
Dirty.
So we didn't know Say Nice Things About Detroit, and I don't know if it's Daft Punk or Kraftwerk at the end there. I think. I don't know.
Ben,
have no
you have
idea.
A guess?
No idea. Those are both are great guesses.
It is Kraftwerk. So
okay.
I'm gonna give you those 13 out of 14, even if you don't have a guess for saying.
I don't
nice
have a guess
thing.
At all. It kind of sounds like Tom Petty, but I know it is not Tom Petty. There's no I have no idea.
Who out there would advise us to say nice things about Detroit? None other than They Might Be Giants.
Oh, I never would have gotten that in a zillion
nice
years.
Guys.
Seriously.
Nice wow. guys. Ben Burton, how did you know the Red Hot Chili Peppers there?
That's just I can't even remember what record is on. I went through a Chili Pepper stage. So,
yeah.
Didn't it sound a little like Queens of the Stone Age, too, with the like single note? Like, but that is Anthony Kiedis once you say it.
Right.
You can hear it. Nice call on the Nickelback.
That means
that Ben also went through a Nickelback stage, right? The transitive property of algebra. We got those two right. that was a brutal. I think that's the only Nickelback I've ever heard, is that little clip right there.
Well, now it might be the only Nickelback. I've never heard Nickelback on purpose. That's for sure.
They played at the basketball game. I'm almost positive they played.
Oh, is that right? Nice. Nice.
All right. Welcome to the Mona Lisa Vito section of the podcast. How well do you know Cars?
Oh, God, I'm dead.
Jeff Simons and Ben Barton. First of all, family car that you remember from the 70s. What did the Simonses drive around Annapolis?
A 1971 Pontiac Le Mans.
Ooh, okay.
As big as our apartment, with huge hubcaps, huge back fins, epic.
Ben Barton, were we driving anything around Brooklyn?
I cover one of my parents' cars every year in torch class for reasonably obvious reasons. Hey, what it was. Ford Pinto wagon.
No, it's
true. Yes.
Unsafe at any speed.
Dad actually totaled it and walked away. So it's pretty impressive.
That is amazing. Also a Detroit car. We had a white Mercury Cougar. You know, the one where you had to, there's a two door. So you had to like get in the back and you had like a submarine port hole.
Oh, God.
As a little kid, you're trying to like look out from that little circular hole in the back seat. It was terrible.
I was so jealous of people who had the backward facing back seat. I thought that was like the most magical thing. Like those Volvos where the back faced the opposite direction.
Oh,
I wanted that so badly.
All right. You guys can work together as a team for this question. Ford's top selling cars of all time. The top three are what? All time from Ford Motor Company.
Does it include trucks or is this just
it
cars?
Does. It does.
So the F-150 would be my first guess.
The Ford F-Series, the number one selling Ford Excellent product job. Of all time. Correct. People like trucks. What is
I'm going to say Bronco.
It is not the Bronco.
Oh, it should be, all though. Right. How about the Ford Escort?
The Ford Escort is correct.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
And you know what? 98% of them went to rental agencies.
Yeah, like, I know,
like,
right?
I rented that car every single time. They were like, here's your Escort. Here's your Escort. Here's your Escort.
And the third bestseller of all time from Ford Motor Company.
Is the Mustang? Or is that too expensive?
It's actually the Model T.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that amazing?
I love that.
Still that is third great. Place.
That's fantastic.
Incredible. All right. Now, this next series of questions is going to determine what level a car person you are.
Okay.
What kind of horsepower did the 1970 Dodge Challenger have?
You mean like the number, or was it a special kind of horsepower?
I mean the number.
Oh, 500.
Jeff,
less than that.
425 horsepower. Okay, so you guys are at the top level, but maybe you'll get
I think 500 is a pretty good guess for that.
It was higher than I would have guessed, sure. Yeah.
I would have said 7.
It's definitely packed with Detroit muscle.
Yes.
What size engine did the Dodge Challenger have in 1970?
A V8.
A V8 is correct. You guys are like upper mid-level car knowledge. My bottom question was, how many wheels did it have? And then I wanted to play a game called How Gritty is Detroit? Detroit had all sorts of race issues in the 1920s. All sorts of violence with unions and corporate bosses. It had as Ben documented, a works force that was kind of laid off and deteriorating downtown section. So this question is, how gritty is Detroit? and I want you to give me a scale of grittiness based on the movie I name. So super gritty, not that gritty. Ready? So, for instance, Gross Point Blank.
Medium gritty. Medium it's gritty. The suburbs, but it's still about murderers.
Good. All right.
I'm going to put not that gritty.
Not that gritty for Gross Point Blank. Action Jackson, starring Carl Weathers.
I saw that, but I have no recollection.
I did too, and I was going to say medium gritty because I'm sure I laughed more than
that
I cried.
That took place in Detroit?
Yes.
Action Jackson.
Wait till I get going here, Ben Barton. The beginning of Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, gritty.
Super gritty indeed.
I love that.
Dark
Shake
Man.
Down, break down.
Break down, baby.
Busted.
Is that a little Bob Seger you're singing? Dark Man.
Gritty. I don't know if I ever saw that, to be honest.
Gran Torino.
Dug it. Enjoyed it. Medium gritty.
Yeah.
RoboCop.
Ooh, so gritty. Dark, so gross, so comically, splatteringly violent.
True Romance.
Oh, I love True Romance. I was just talking about True Romance yesterday.
Were you really?
That was awesome.
Oh, I talk about that dumb movie all the time.
And I think I recommended to RoboCop to my...
or toilet paper, I do Floyd.
I recommended RoboCop to my parents, I think, and I think I'm still paying for that. I think they're still traumatized by how awful violent that movie was.
That was violent. And I never saw Four Brothers, but that looked pretty darn gritty. Mark Wahlberg. And finally, in our I will not be taking any
but you're
questions.
Not going to do Dr. Detroit?
I was going to say.
Dr. Detroit.
How could you miss Dr. Detroit?
That movie.
Is that when Dan Aykroyd thought
yes,
he could go off on his own?
And his future wife.
Oh, golly. That's a dog of a movie. I will not be taking any questions. The greatest movie of all time set in Detroit is Mr. Mom. Thank you very much.
Where's Mommy keep the extra diapers?
Let's go to favorite son. Gosh, there's only one answer to the favorite son or daughter of Detroit. It is Eminem, the 10th best-selling artist of all time in music history. Eminem, let's go with Slim Shady, shall we?
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? Will the real Slim Shady please stand up? I repeat, will the real Slim Shady stand up. We're gonna have a problem here.
Y'all act like you never seen a white person before. Jaws all on the floor like Pam, like Tommy just burst in the door. And started whooping her ass worse than before. They first were divorced, sewing her over furniture. It's the return of the... Oh, wait, no, wait, you're kidding. He didn't just say what I think he did he? And Dr. Dre said... Nothing, you idiots. Dr. Dre's dead. He's locked in my basement. Feminist women love Eminem.
Chicka, 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 Slim Shady. I'm sick of him. Look at him walking around, grabbing his you-know-what, flipping the you-know-who. Yeah, but he's so cute, though.
Yeah, I probably got a couple of screws up in my head loose, but no worse than what's going on in your parents' bedrooms. Sometimes I want to get on TV and just let loose, but can't. But it's cool for Tom Green to hump a dead moose. My bum is on your lips. My bum is on your lips. And if I'm lucky, you might just give it a little kiss. And that's the message that we deliver to little kids and expect them not to know what a woman's clitoris is. Of course they're gonna know what intercourse is. By the time they hit fourth grade, they got the Discovery Channel, don't they? We ain't nothing but mammals. Well, some of us cannibals who cut other people open like cantaloupes. But if we can hunt dead animals and antelopes, then there's no reason that a man and another man can't elope. But if you feel like I feel, I got the antidote. Women wave your pantyhose, sing the chorus, and it goes.
I'm Slim Shady, yes, I'm the real Shady. All you other Slim Shadys are just imitating. So
want the
real... Wow. That is not his most listened song.
No, his most listened song is Lose Yourself in the Moment.
As well as it should be. I think that's his best song. So.
Oh, I prefer this one. I like Lose Yourself too, but so just a word on Eminem. So first, he is in fact the best-selling rapper of all time, which is worrisome. And second, I have a love-hate relationship with him. Or really, it's more like I have a like-hate relationship. I've never loved Eminem. The first couple of records I did think were good. And in particular, that song is super emblematic of what was good about it. Like, he used to be really funny. He used to try really, really, really hard to be funny and kind of steer into being a goofy white guy. And over time, he became more and more serious, and that did not work out for him at all. It's also, it's not his fault, I guess, but it's not a good look at all that he's the top selling rap artist. He's not even in the top 10 rap artists. All of that being said, people who are in the top 10 rap artists, like Kendrick Lamar or Dr. Dre, and depending how you feel about it, I love J. Cole, but all of them have really, really high praise for Eminem, and like actual granular praise, not like he made a lot of money, so he's fine. But like, I like his flow. I like his rhythm. Catch these couplets, see how he does the words within the words.
Right.
And he is, despite me not liking it, he's a legit artist. Like, he actually has something to say and has lived a really weird, bizarre, very upsetting life where he is, in fact, is like a super troubled person. And the art reflects that. And I can't help but respect that. The movie itself, like, that's just like super autobiographical, like really, really, really autobiographical. Yeah. Like, being a white poor kid in Detroit coming up and having your friends be black and rap and trying to rap too was super tough. He's backed it up. Like, he still lives in a fancy mansion in the suburbs of Detroit. Like, he's a little bit like Prince that way. Like, he came home, lives there. He is still a huge booster of the Detroit hip hop scene. There's like three dudes who came up together. There's Royce da 5'9", Proof, and Eminem. And the other two guys are black and Eminem's white. And they were in and out of rap acts together with each other and stayed good friends. And Eminem boosted them his whole career. Like, on the very first Eminem record, there's a Royce da 5'9" song with him. And he signed him to the record label and kept him going. All that, Royce da 5'9", though, is my actual favorite Detroit rapper. And if Aretha Franklin were not from Detroit, that's who I would be choosing. Jeff always gets to get the hipster cred. I will just lead people to PHRYME Prime, which is half DJ Premier, who's the DJ from Gangstar and just a really old school rap guy, and Royce da 5'9". It is a fantastic, exceptionally good rap album from, I think, 2017.
Hipster cred given, Ben.
Yeah, this is what we need.
I think Eminem is, I think of Eminem and Kurt Cobain in almost exactly the same way. When you got two troubled white kids who find themselves extraordinarily famous very suddenly, who are both deeply troubled. And I mean, I think it's a good thing that Eminem isn't dead, you know? And it's funny, right?
Because, I totally agree with that.
Like, Eminem figured out a way to live.
He's attempted suicide on more than one occasion.
Yeah, and the art went sideways because he was either going to make that art and die or become a different kind of artist and live. But I think of both of them. Both of them are 90s superstars who hate the fame monster that gave them all of their opportunity and success. Like, both of them appeared on every single National Magazine giving it the finger. And I just think there's such a weird thing about the 90s. It was like, you know, Rolling Stone sucks and the source of words are stupid. And there they are on the cover of those magazines.
Again,
like,
and again.
Selling copies of the mag. Like, neither of them could figure out how to just step sideways and be like, I don't need to be the absolute big. And I feel like the legacy of Cobain and Eminem for a lot of artists is, you see yourself getting too big and you like, and now with social media and the internet and the own means of production, you can avoid the catastrophic fame that almost swallowed both of them. So I think there's an interesting, like Jack White could just as easily be Kurt Cobain or Eminem. And instead he was like, I think I'll move to the woods and do it all myself very weirdly, and just cultivate a niche audience and protect my sanity and privacy. And that wasn't really available yet in the 90s technologically. And so for me, people who knew they weren't the very best in their genres, who were lauded as the very best, who tried to look ugly in photographs, even though they were both really attractive people, and who hated the fame monster that also pulled them out of poverty in small, terrible towns and gave them the life they actually deeply, desperately wanted. But they had to do it so publicly that they couldn't enjoy it. So I have real sympathy for Eminem. And like Ben, never really spoke to me. Like, his white male rage was not my white male rage. Like, I never listened to an Eminem record. It's like, oh, finally, someone's speaking on my
behalf. Yeah.
Like, I just, like, I thought it was either cartoonish or deeply troubling. So,
and he's played Bonnaroo twice as a headliner, and the 2011, both times he did all of my favorites, all of the early best songs he did as a medley in 2.5 minutes, which is exactly raw. I understand that, you know, he's a gargantuan act and people don't like to play their old stuff, but I mean, help a brother out. And then second, the second time was, I guess, 2017 or 18, and it was just me and India went, and it was so vile and loud and violent. And there was like machine gun shots between every single song and a whole bunch of like animated machine guns flying all over the stage. And India was like, I just can't watch this. Super upsetting. And I was like, fair, super fair. Like, it's a really off-putting, ultra violent, gun obsessed performance. Not likable.
Ugh. Ugh. All right. Well, we got to move on. We are, we're picking our artists. We're going 8 minutes for each artist. 8 minutes and done.
You know, maybe the podcast just is becoming a long form 2-part podcast, guys. I'm open to the idea.
First of all, now you have 7.5 minutes, okay? The more you
I'll go first and I'll keep it short. I'll keep it short. Although, like, what a stupid moment to start to go short when we have two of the greatest artists in American history coming up.
That's
Steveland Morris, born in Saginaw, Michigan, put in an incubator and mishandled as an infant, causing permanent blindness. Moves to Detroit, Michigan at the young age of 4 with his mom and his family. Mom leaves. The family splits up, raised by a single mom. Then another guy comes back. It's a turbulent upbringing, but he sings in the church and the choir, and he is a profound prodigy. And a budding local record label called Motown Records makes a novelty record. Like, look at this little kid. Like, this little blind kid can sing and play the harmonica. It's kind of crazy. They put out a song called Fingertips, and it's a regional hit, and they give him a new name, Little Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing about Stevie Wonder. There's two moments in his career. There's the moment when he's a Motown act, and they're telling him what to sing and play and do, and he's doing all of the hits being written for him, as you mentioned before, Tim, like Holland, Dozier Holland, and those guys. He's amazing. If you think about just the Stevie Wonder before his 21st birthday, he's in the Hall of Fame. He's a first ballot, unbelievable artist, right? Like, there's too many songs to mention, but, you know, Uptight, Everything's All Right, and For Once in My Life, and I Was Made to Love Her, and Signed, Sealed, Delivered, and there's so many. And he's a phenomenal prodigy, right? He doesn't just sing and play the harmonica. He plays the piano great. He plays the drums really well. Like, you put an instrument in that kid's hands and he can master it in a couple of hours. And so the live show is medleys of all these Motown hits with Stevie hopping around on different instruments and showing off how badass he is.
Right.
If you haven't seen Summer of Soul yet, Questlove's movie that starts with Stevie on the drums, it's just one of those, like, oh, that's what profound genius looks like. But you could throw out everything Stevie Wonder does before his 21st birthday and just look at the stuff he does between age 21 and age 25 and make an argument that he's the greatest American musical artist of all time. It's so, while he's making all these records, Stevie's waiting to turn 21 so he can renegotiate his record contract with Berry Gordy and have complete and total control of it. And he's stockpiling tunes. Like, he's writing his own stuff. And every once in a while, they'll let him record one of his. But for the most part, he's part of the Motown hit machine. And so when he turns 21, they rewrite the contract. And Barry's like, okay, I'm ready for the next record. He's like, well, I have the first 4 written and recorded, and I'm almost done with the 5th. And so he puts out Music of My Mind, Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfilling This First Finale, and then somehow needs an extra 8 months to finish Songs in the Key of Life, which is a double album with a bonus EP four songs that couldn't fit on the double album that comes out. That's 1971 to 1976. That's seven albums of original material, essentially recorded by one guy by himself with the occasional help of guest stars on the horns or on vocals or on guitar. But it's basically just a young blind kid in a studio left to his own devices. Uh-huh. And I don't think there'll be an outpouring of material. I mean, I guess you could argue that like Zach Bryan is on a Stevie Wonder-ish output meter, right? I mean, the guy's just putting out songs. And, maybe I haven't heard it yet with Zach Bryan, but maybe there's like a similarity there of just a guy when the iron is hot, just trying to get as much material out. But what's incredible is most people that put out that kind of material are putting out, you know, it's not all great, right? Like I love Prince so much, but the 8-disc Sign of the Times box set has one or two clunkers. He's putting out an 8-CD version of Diamonds and Pearls next month. So it's the original 11-track record and then 38 outtakes from those sessions.
Wow.
But if you go through these records, it takes till side two of Songs in the Key of Life before you hit a song where you're like, well, that's objectively a bad song. There are so many winners, so many great songs over and over and over and over. And they Wonder's voice, like he's a shit hot drummer. I love Stevie Wonder's drumming so much. He turns the clavinet into a rock and roll instrument basically by himself, right? The piano playing, the harmonica playing, but the guy's voice, Stevie Wonder's voice is American history and American joy. Like it's inexhaustibly outstanding. I just find myself so often listening to Stevie Wonder and the effortless, outstanding communication that guy has. And then it's gone. Like when he released a song in the Key of Life, he's 24 freaking years old. He's 24. And it's the last great Stevie Wonder album. He's 73 years old. And he keeps making records and he's whatever finger he's got on the pulse, he loses. Right. Ben knows I constantly say soul singers and comedians get like a 5-year window.
Yeah.
And then they're just not in the zeitgeist anymore. And who cares? Like this mid-70s output from Stevie Wonder, it should be for me the real soundtrack of America in that decade. I'm going to pick the song. It's a big hit. It's not like a deep cut or anything. It's one of the songs that really changed my life. When I was 22, 23 years old in my second year of working at Branson, I was just an absolute workaholic. As opposed to now when I have such great balance. But I mean, I really was working like 70 hours a week trying to be good. And I never went out. I was just work, sleep. And I got dragged out into San Francisco on a Friday night. I was exhausted. I almost didn't go and I couldn't find parking. Then I went to Nikki's Lounge on Haight Street, which is a shitty little dance club. And I get there and I don't see anybody I know. And, you know, like I'm a 23-year-old, like, doofus 5'6" kid in a crowded bar at night, and just when I see two people I know, the DJ drops this song and the whole crowd just becomes one organism. It's just this like, thank you, finally something everybody knows is just perfect, and the whole crowd just becomes this one organism. And for the next 5.5 minutes I like lose all my like weirdness and self awareness and just melt into this sea of young people all just searching for something. And I swear to God, it just something clicked for me that night about like, just be yourself, you idiot. And I went on a Stevie Wonder binge that probably has not abated. So this is I can't thank Stevie Wonder enough and the DJ that hit it at just the right moment for giving me an adult life worth living. And this is Boogie on Reggae Woman.
Ooh.
That's the hardest thing in the world to fade that song out.
This is so over great.
In the middle where he starts playing the harmonica and he yells, "Can I play?" And that's just for me, that's church. That moment when Stevie's like asks permission to play his harmonica. I'm just like, no matter where I am, I'm like, go, Stevie, yes, please.
That's so great. Yeah, I thought you talked about like finding yourself in this moment in this bar and like, and then you said, and I went on a, and I thought you were going to say some sort of like Lothario binge or something like that.
If
that's
only.
What I started.
No,
meet
I'm still
people.
Me. Like it was
I went on a Stevie Wonder binge. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. great stuff, Ben. What'd you think?
Jeff nailed it. Those are fantastic records. One thing that's super notable about them is they're recorded all bang 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 on top of each other, and they really evolve. Yeah. They're really, really, really evolutionary and revolutionary and different. The fifth record sounds so different from the first record. You can see his thought process building through it, just bang, 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 bang on top of it all. Fantastic. Love it.
All right. We're moving on. You did great, Jeff Simons. Ben Barton, you got 8 minutes
now. I take direction well, Timmy.
Aretha Franklin, born March 25th, 1942 in, where's she born, Jeff?
I don't know.
Detroit.
Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, I love it.
Her dad, C.L. Franklin, is an itinerant, wandering Baptist preacher. Then he gets a gig in Buffalo. He and his wife and his kids move up to Buffalo for a couple of years, and then he gets his big break. He is the Baptist preacher at New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit, Rock City, one of the biggest Baptist churches in the country. And it's funny to say, I mean, this is like doing this sort of research always makes me super happy. This guy was a legit, hugely famous preacher.
Yeah.
Like, they said he had $1 million voice, and he was like simulcast on the radio all over the Midwest on black radio stations. Just fantastic. He and his wife split up. He's a notorious womanizer, despite being a Baptist preacher, or maybe because he's a Baptist preacher, your mileage will vary. She's got multiple different siblings. When her mom leaves, her dad puts her into the choir and makes her the lead voice in the choir. And so she's an actual legit child star. Like, her career has got this first 4 years from, like, her first recording that was a hit is when she's 14 years old. And she's got this gospel from 14 to 18. She tells her dad that she admires Sam Cooke and she wants to be a pop musician. And her dad says, fine. He takes over as her manager. She's asked to join. Sam Cooke is like, do RCA Victor. Like, they know me. They know you. They'll put you in the right place. That's where it's all happening. And Berry Gordy pitches them on joining the label. Dad says, no, I prefer to go with Columbia Records. And there's a whole series of these unbelievably stupid decisions made by the males in their life.
Oh.
So this is a terrible, terrible decision. And actually, at the end of this, I'm going to argue that weirdly, Aretha Franklin's career, as amazing it was worse than it should have been. Like, if you replay Aretha's life 10 times, at least 6 or 7 of her careers are way better.
No question. She's like the person, she's like Otani being stuck on the Angels.
Totally.
Like, it's just like, they waste 7 years of excellence with her. Yep.
9 albums. She has a 9 album deal with Columbia. And they call it a 5%er because she only gets 5% of the money from it. Dude, this is how badly I went with Columbia. When she leaves Columbia in 67 to go over and join Atlantic Records, she owes Columbia money.
Yeah,
because she hasn't sold enough records to cover the recording of it.
And I mean,
and so
How many times have you tried to find one or two good Columbia recordings?
Totally. Dude, right? Listen, like, I'm going to go ahead and just challenge the good people listening here. Go back, and I'm going to, first of all, it's actually really fun. I've done this exact project. So you just go back and you randomly choose one of these nine records, and you just randomly choose one of the songs on the nine records, and it's bad. You're like, yeah. I can't believe it. And it's like a Ferrari with a restrictor plate on.
Yeah.
Like, so mannerly, these songs. Like, they thought that she was a crooning jazz artist. They had her locked in the basement, like, held down, like, just crushing her. And dude, that's insane enough when you find out what happened in 67. It's even more insane. She was named the Queen of Soul in 1964, not in 1967. And she was named the Queen of Soul because her live act was so legendary that the African-American station in Chicago played one of her concerts. And the guy was like, WVON was like, that's the Queen of Soul. She's it. That's
Let's
all.
Let's go.
And then, nobody would buy the records because the records are so crappy. So it's not only that the records were bad. It's that if they attended a show, they wouldn't have been like, well, that was strange. The show was 8,000 times better than the records we're putting out. I wonder what we're doing wrong. No one had that thought at Columbia. In the meantime, she gets married to her first husband, another piece of shit, Ted White. All right,
Ted is the worst.
So he's like described by various people as a pimp, a hustler, a loser. His dad hated him. Her whole family hated him. He's abusive. He beat her up in front of other people. He gets signed to Atlantic Records. They get on a Muscle Shoals. They record I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You and Do Right Woman. They start Do Right Woman, Do Right Man. Ted White, the piece of shit, gets in a fight with Aretha, then gets in a fight with the manager of the studio, and it punches the guy in the horn section. They push him out. The guys at Muscle Shoals are like, I don't know why you signed this woman to Atlantic. Her husband's a fucking lunatic. We've got to stop recording. Like, she's banned from the studio. In Muscle Shoals. Wexler, the guy who's running Atlantic Records, is like, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. We're gonna bring it up to New York, and we'll just finish Do Right Woman, Do Right Man as the B-side, and we'll put out I Never Loved a Man, and we'll see how it goes. Massive gargantuan hit. All of the Muscle Shoals guys are flown back up to New York, and we are off to the races with it. I always pick I Never Loved a Man as my favorite Aretha record, and thus basically one of my, I don't know, 20 favorite records. Like, I just can't describe how beautiful this record is, how much I love this record. I had a really fun argument with now Dahlia's On a Break boyfriend, but then boyfriend, where he was like, oh, Lady Soul, that's the best one. And
boo.
Lady Soul has got a bunch of great songs on it. And in fact, it has probably, I mean, it doesn't have Respect on it, but I mean, it's Chain of Fools. It has a bunch of great songs on it. Here's the thing that's so amazing about I Never Loved a Man is it's not just that she changed her sound. It's not just that they figured out what to do with her. It's that half of the songs on that record are written by Aretha.
There you go.
And the piano on that record is played by Aretha. And you can't believe what a freaking spectacular pianist she is. So beautiful. The arrangements are so beautiful. And so this is another part of the career that just makes me a little bit sad. You go look at just the Wikipedia entry with the discography. She puts out three albums a year from 67 to 70. And they've just got her on the Rented Mule treatment. And again, everyone made a lot of money. I assume that she made some money, and I know Atlantic made a lot of money. But dude, by the time you get to Lady Soul, she doesn't have time to write anything.
She's
on a never-ending tour, and she's in the, like, when she's not touring, she's in the studio, and so they're just giving her songs to play. And I'm sure she's super amped. I mean, she's been toiling in the salt mines under the stupid Columbia record contract. She finally gets a chance. But there's a different version of her story where they learn a different lesson from I Never Loved a Man. And they're like, you know what, Aretha? Take 6 months, write a whole record.
Right.
Write a whole record of originals expressing what you have to say. And like that version of her career, I pine for. Like, it just hurts my heart because they beat it out of her. And then so she stopped playing the piano, basically. Like, all of her concerts, she's singing. And it's not like she's a bad singer. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying, like, there's a version of Aretha Franklin, original artist, singer-songwriter, that I would pay any amount of money to see.
The Stevie Wonder version of Aretha Franklin. Or the Carole King version. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. By the early 70s, she's just blown through it all. Like, she's completely burnt out. She's gotten divorced. She's got a pretty, and this is allegedly, substantial drinking problem. Like, she's just been working all the way through there. And so she goes into the sallow period. Then there's the comeback. And the comeback is super hilarious, too. So we previously talked about Blues Brothers. That starts it. She is thinking the Blues Brothers. That kicks it off. And then she's got this, and she signs to Arista Records. And she's got this whole unbelievably bad sounding group of hit songs. I actually went back today and listened to Freeway of Love.
Isn't that amazing?
I would challenge everybody on the podcast to just go listen to Freeway of Love. You can't believe how bad the instrumentation is. And the other thing is, I was sitting in the car with Georgia, and I was like, the funniest thing about this is it's a good song. It's a good song.
Yeah.
But if you just took Aretha, and Aretha's vocals are characteristically fantastic on that song. Like, if you just replaced it with a Muscle Shoals guy, it would be an actual classic. Instead, it's just a harrowing punishment to listen to them program the machinery that's behind her, including this like a little bongo solo in the chorus, ruining the chorus.
You know, that's the same year as Part-Time Lover, Stevie Wonder. Equally
Golly.
Horrified.
Golly.
I mean, what can you say? That was the sound of the time.
That's rough.
But somehow it's just really wears worse for her. That's irony, though. That song's great. I can't remember the name of it. Whatever the duet with George Michael is, that's a great song. Again, instrumentation is a disaster. A Rose is a Rose is a good song. Like that is another one that could actually sound good. And then she gets this late period, I'm a great singer, diva thing. That includes some really hilarious highlights. So one highlight is the greatest WrestleMania entry song of all time.
Wait, what?
Aretha singing America the Beautiful. I'm not kidding. If you look up the Wikipedia for WrestleMania 3, it is. Widely claimed as the best. And by the way, I watched that video. Accurate. It's fantastic.
Wow.
And then there's the famous time where she's at the Grammys and Pavarotti is supposed to sing an aria and he gets food poisoning and she goes out with no practice and sings it.
Sings an aria?
A Pavarotti aria note for note perfectly.
Wait, where is that? I got to find that on YouTube.
She's just an insane, like unbelievably super awesome singer. That's how good a singer she was. And dude, she died in Detroit. She lived in Detroit. Freeway of Love, I actually should choose because that's a legit Detroit song. You know what I mean? Like, it's a driving song. It's a stuck in traffic song.
Yeah.
It's a My Pink Cadillac is What Love Looks Like song. I'm not going to choose that, though. I'm going to choose a well-known but lesser-known one from I Never Loved a Man. And this is an Aretha original. Her sister's credited on it, too, but she wrote it for sure. And it just murders me every single time. Baby, baby, baby. So that song's got it all, man. You can hear the gospel part. Like, she adds the singers in the back. And I assume Jeff will agree with me. I mean, the Muscle Shoals band. Good night.
You know how hard it is to play that slow?
Night.
It's impossible.
Dude, this is one of those ones that's such a rich text. Like, next time you go back, just listen to the bass. There's parts of the bass is just like boom.
Yeah.
Boom. And then when it reaches the crescendo, he goes up the neck. He's fucking flying.
Yeah.
And the guitar part is so unbelievably tasty. Just like these little touches and flourishes as you go along. Oh, just. And then the horns come. That one just absolutely kills me every single time. And it's this beautiful, sad love song for her as she's just touring 300 nights a year, doesn't get to see, I mean, her husband's a piece of shit, but still, like, she doesn't get to see him, and she's hurting his feelings, and she'd rather hurt herself. Like, that one just sings to me above all the rest.
I can't believe she had a 9-album deal.
Isn't that crazy?
A nine album. Like,
it's really funny. Jeff has probably done the exact same thing. I've actually listened. I didn't listen to the whole of each song, but I've listened to every single song on those records. Yep. I gave it the extra college try,
and nothing.
It's just bad.
Incredible.
Really
it's bad. Just like it's like giving a cook 5-star ingredients, and it always comes out like a Denny's omelet. Like I just can't. It's shocking. I think I never loved a man
like,
is.
It's like a really forward thinking cook, and they're like, "Oh no, we're a burger place."
Yeah.
Gotta make a burger. That's what we serve. That's and the right. person's like, but you know, I had some thoughts I about some tweaking thoughts. The burger. And nope. They were like, no, nope.
It's like the bear behind you.
I think I Never Loved a Man's the greatest record by a female artist in rock and roll history.
Ooh,
I think it's number
I like
one.
That.
I think Joni Mitchell's Blue is probably number two for me, but yeah, okay. I think I Never Loved a Man is the one. If I had to pick one, it's just, I've never gotten tired of it. I mean, I don't know, 500 listens? I never gotten tired of it. It's if you haven't heard it, track 1 to 11 in sequence, you got to check it out. Cause you know, you'll be like, I know all these songs, they come on the radio all the time, but hearing them right. in order, it's a journey, man. It's a great,
dude, and that's a half a
great
dozen
artistic statement.
Save me. I mean, there's a half dozen songs you haven't heard ever, or you haven't heard in a long time. And they're great.
Yeah.
All of them are great. Every single song is just continuously fantastic.
All right. I'm doing it. I'm doing it, later today. Well, I got to go. So I have a wacky idea. You ready for my wacky idea?
Oh, good Lord. Now we're going to spend a whole podcast talking about Bob Seger. You're the worst, Tim.
Gas up on Bob Seger. Everyone has to take – this is your homework, and you actually have to do your homework this time. Your favorite Bob Seger song and the most unforgivable Bob Seger song. That's your homework for our next podcast.
Okay, I'm going to talk more about Aretha. That's my plan. When you get to the Bob Seger parts, that's what I'm going to
do. We're going to do a gas up on Bob Seger?
Yeah.
Can it be called Bob Seger, what in the actual fuck? ?! Exclamation point.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. All right. We got to go, though. We got to go.
Well, so we need to, listeners, we talked ourselves into a corner. Guys, we need to make a longer moment because we can't the good stuff the good Jeff, stuff's flowing
Jeff
this
Simons
podcast
you're right.
is becoming past the Courvoisier, man.
Your idea is not a bad one. We record every Monday night or every other Monday night, and it's like the first half the second half. That way we can be doing this well into our 70s.
That's true. You know, my dad told me when I was five.
If we go every artist all the way down to Bob Seger gets a gas up, that means that we have 800,000 artists to cover.
Dude, Tim, I can't believe.
Like, what have we done so far? We did Dylan.
Tom Petty.
We haven't even done Springsteen yet, and we're going to do Bob Seger. That's your current plan.
Well, I think Tim's going to make the argument that it's like, you know, tomato, clamato. With Springsteen and Bob Seger.
Actually, my musical insight it involves that because I've always told my kids that Seger is the Detroit Springsteen because they're like, is this Seger?
Why do you hate your children, Tim? Why do you hate them? Do you want them to sound stupid when they talk to other people?
My new insight is he's the Detroit Billy Joel.
I broke the internet.
And
that's perfect.
We will discuss that. On our next podcast. Gentlemen.
You know what's great?
By the way, Billy Joel's way better. So much better.
I might even make that argument myself. And we have me on record for how irritating Billy Joel is to me. And I
love that idea that you're going
to
defend.
I don't know
Billy
which
Joel.
One I'd rather be stuck in a rowboat with, but I think I'd rather listen to Billy Joel. This is going to be a great episode. I can't wait.
Goodbye, gentlemen.
All right, that was well done.
Welcome to Tuning Into Sound Wellbeing, where we harmonise your mind, body and soul. I'm Amanda, your sound therapy expert.
And I'm Stephen, the curious explorer uncovering the mysteries of sound.
Together we explore vibrations, frequencies and the power of sound therapy and tuning forks.
Discover ancient wisdom, reduce stress and tune into a healthier life. Subscribe to Tuning Into Sound Wellbeing today.
Welcome to Ringside with Ray and Prince. My name is Ray Leonard Jr.
Oh, we got this chair. No, that's just my dad.
My name is Prince Daniels Jr.
Daniels again with a big home touchdown.
On this show, we come to humanize
athletes, entertainers, business executives. We're going to see what makes them tick.
Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll see you there. Peace and power.
Electric acid. Electric acid.